Welcome back to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and we're going to spend an hour together talking about caregiving. Caregiving is just what it says it is. It's giving care. Giving care to someone that you love, someone you care about. Sometimes it's just a visit. Sometimes it's preparing a meal or delivering a meal. Sometimes it's a great deal more than that. There are levels and levels of caregiving. We're going to speak today with Nancy and with Margaret about their experiences in caring for their aging parents. It will introduce the topic of caregiving, and we're going to expand on that. It's estimated that 3 out of 5 people in the general population will at some time in their life be caregivers. They come from all walks of life, all backgrounds. Many people are still working full-time. Some people take time off from their jobs to be caregivers, but it comes in many varieties. And for everyone, there's a giving of your time, sometimes of your money, certainly of your emotions, and it impacts the family in many ways. It changes the dynamics in a relationship when you move from being a friend to being a caregiver, from being a child to being a parent to your parents. And we're going to talk about a number of these challenges. Stay with us now as we take a little bit of a break, and we'll be right back. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on the website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clenton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. Our first guest today is Nancy Nittickman from Brookline, Massachusetts. As you listen to her story, listen for how the dynamics begin to change between herself and her parents.
Well, my parents were living in Iowa, which is their home, and had been traveling back and forth to Tucson every winter for a number of years. And as they aged, the traveling became a little more difficult. My mother also kept a kosher home, which had additional requirements on how she cooked her meals and things like that in Iowa.
Right.
But as I say, as they aged, the traveling became more difficult. And in fact, I had been discussing with her changing the living arrangements because it was difficult for her to cook at home. And while she had some support to take my parents out, my father was still driving, but it wasn't clear he should be driving. So over a year or two, I was sort of negotiating with her about changing the living arrangements and saying, look, you really shouldn't be here in Iowa alone. You can have some help at home if that would work. You can move to be near me in Boston. You can move to be near my brother in Chicago. You can choose to stay in Tucson, where we have family and friends and where they, you know, been going for years. But this seems very hard. And finally, after one trip, there was a new assisted living place being built in Tucson, and that was a sensible place for them to choose to stay because they had family and friends, and they've been very, very comfortable there. And this was, in fact, a new building or a new facility being added onto an already existing nursing home area. It was also Jewish, which was turned out to be important to my folks, or a plus, let's say.
So this was one of those facilities where you buy into a little apartment. It's like having a condo. And then if you should need nursing care, it's available on premises.
Similar. It was a continuing care facility, which is what you're talking about in the sense of you may be independent. And then as you need more care, it's there and you don't have to move out. But we didn't have to buy. I put a deposit down before they were even willing to take deposits. I said, no, this is going to be the place. And sure enough, a year later, they broke ground and then they opened and I did move my parents in. But this was a rental. It was really an apartment. Mm-hmm. And It included as much support as you wanted. It included a certain amount without extra expenditure. Mm-hmm. And then if you wanted more services, you paid on a sliding scale or whatever. I don't even recall. But at the beginning, my parents needed very little assistance. And that's how we arranged it. And then they'd been there a year and a half. They were getting a little assistance with showers, and the meals were taken care of. They had a main dining room, so they were able to go down there for two meals a day or three, whatever they wanted. Hmm. And it was quite a wonderful, well, it had its problems, but it was working effectively for them.
Right.
And then my mother, by this time, my mother had turned 90, and my father was 92. My mother died fairly quickly. She had it happened in a week, which I would wish on all of us, but anyway.
Right, there are worse ways to go.
There are worse ways, that's right. It was really a fast event. And my dad, who was then, as I say, 92, he had some history of of TIAs, so there would be occasional episodes of confusion, which had been happening over a period of years. And my mother was fairly used to handling that. At first, they used to take him to the emergency room, but by the time he was there, these symptoms were gone, and they tested him out for an hour, and they'd send him home.
So a series of little mini-strokes.
Little mini-strokes, that's right, which typically manifested themselves in some form of confusion. So I was concerned, and also he was becoming more frail physically.
Right.
On the other hand, they'd been in this apartment for a year and a half, so that was his home by now.
Right.
And I didn't want to move him, and I didn't want to treat him like an invalid. So I thought, well, what's the best way to go here? He was in the right place, I thought, but I didn't want to have him be alone all the time. And they had been... They weren't overly sociable in terms of doing activities at this community. Mm. They would dine with people there and had regular people that enjoyed their company and things like that. But they didn't typically go downstairs during the day. Watched some television, read, you know, did the crossword puzzles, this kind of thing. And my father didn't change his habits after that either. So I decided I would get some assistance, like a companion for part of each day, and take the risk that he wasn't going to get confused and do something crazy or fall over or whatever. So I did. I found an agency, which we can talk about, and I did some referral checking, and I was very fortunate in hiring a woman. Well, actually, it went through some iterations, but I did find somebody who spent like 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon, and then I had somebody else on the weekends. And I discussed it with my father, and I said, well, I think it'd be good for you to have somebody, but I don't want to, you know, crowd you or stifle you. And he said, he didn't think he needed any help, but anyway, he agreed. And this is what we did. And this worked for about 9 months, and then one day he was trying to open a pill bottle, which of course was childproof. He struggled with it,
and
he lost his balance. He fell. Yeah, child and elderly proof, I guess.
Right.
He fell, and he broke a bone in his left shoulder. And again, we were very fortunate, because if you're going to fall, you're right-handed. So this to me was the call to say, okay, now we're going to change the arrangement. And then I. Mm-hmm. Got 24-hour care from then on. And again, you have to understand, I was paying, and I was in an assisted living place. I mean, this was expensive, but he could afford it. So we just chose not to move him, and in a sense, double pay, because we were paying for caregivers while we were also paying for an assisted living facility.
Right, right.
But we did that, and I should add that I live in Boston, and my parents, and then subsequently my dad, was in Tucson. So we had issues of how to handle this long distance, but it worked. And in a thumbnail sketch, that's what happened until the end of his life, which also came very quickly. And he had we don't exactly know, but he probably had a stroke that affected the brainstem, which they couldn't diagnose or they didn't detect. He had a problem. He went into the hospital. They sent him home a few days later because he seemed to be fine, and he was. But then something else happened. And so within a week, he also died. So all in all, I think my family was very fortunate. So that is, I think, a thumbnail sketch of...
Right. Now, you had your own work life going on in parallel with all this.
Well, actually, Joyce, I was in a very unique and fortunate position because I stopped working. I retired, so to speak. Right around the time, but not because of my family needing more help. I had been with a company, and it was being sold, and I had a certain kind of severance package, and I thought, gee, I don't think this new company is going to be much fun for me. And I stopped working, and that was really about the time that they needed more help traveling back and forth from Iowa to Tucson, and then I could, and I was in a position to think more about and anticipate what might be required as they aged. So I was really very, very lucky. And my brother's working in Chicago, and my brother also has a home in Tucson. He was able to help to the degree that I asked him to, but in a sense, I took charge, and I really didn't want him to get too involved because two chiefs sometimes are much too difficult.
Right. But he and his family were able to do some visiting.
Absolutely. And in fact, after my mother died, I said to my brother, I think that we can, we didn't know what to expect in terms of my father and how he would take her passing. But I said to him, I think that we can keep him in a fairly good place, but we need to be there. And I go, I can't do it by myself because I'm coming from Boston. And when I go, I stay 10 days at a time, let's say.
Right.
But I need your help. And he said, and he made a commitment to go once a month for a long weekend or a weekend. And he did. He did. And, which is, again, very remarkable.
From Chicago. Right.
So, as I say, we were fortunate and probably able to do something that most families can't do because I wasn't working and my father was sufficiently financially able to help make all this happen.
Right.
So I was out there every 6 to 8 weeks. I would go for 7 to 10 days he died over 3.5 years after my mother died.
Mm-hmm.
So the cycle was really from 2001 to 2006, the whole cycle from the time they moved, and then she died in 2003.
We're speaking with Nancy Nedickman of Boston, Massachusetts, and learning from her experience. And you've seen how her relationship with her parents evolved from being a child of these parents to beginning to take more and more responsibility as they needed her to pitch in. And a negotiation process where she was able to respectfully elicit their opinion and get their cooperation in making the moves to greater and greater assistance as they aged. Let's take a little break and we'll be back with Nancy to learn more lessons from her experience. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. We're back talking with Nancy Nedickman. What kinds of lessons did you learn out of this? Because this was a whole new experience for you.
Yes, it was. I think the ability to find the right caregivers, and we did have some turnover, including we had to fire a couple of people. But that's just critical, finding somebody that's good, that you can rely on, that you can trust, and that cares for these people, that mm-hmm. has an interest in these human beings,
right.
and doesn't just see somebody elderly who can therefore take their hourly pay and go home. And we, again, were extremely fortunate in finding the first person we found was a woman who worked part-time for my dad, and then continued on and took then 7-hour, 8-hour shifts after my mother died. And I sort of put her in charge, in a sense, of the other caregivers. And she was my eyes and ears mm. while I was geographically away, far away. And I think that is critical, and you sort of have to have somebody managing the situation on the spot. And I also think you need somebody in charge, a family member that's sort of in charge. It's difficult, I think, to manage it as a group, even though all the siblings may try and may want to, and there's no question everybody loves the parent. I don't think that's an issue. But you need to have somebody take the responsibility there has to be a decision maker, I think. Mm-hmm. It can be very hard otherwise. And then I would also say I think I was fortunate because my parents had their wits about them and were able to agree to these things. I don't know what I would have done. I'd never had to say, we're going to do this, like it or not.
Right.
I think you can be forced into that situation, but I didn't have that happen. So again, I tried to work with my parents. As I said, I initially negotiated with my mother over a year or two, really. Mm-hmm. And then she realized the time was now, and we did it. And then my father was, I think my father actually enjoyed the caregivers, and they bonded with him. And it Good. Turns out they were all women, and I think that turned out to be just the right thing for my dad, who always liked uh-huh. women and, you know, enjoyed their company.
Right.
And so I would say that's critical because I really believe, and my brother believes as well, that I think they kept him alive comfortably for those years, not physically, but they kept him
stimulated company.
And engaged,
right.
and he understood that they cared for him, and they had their personal exchanges. He was not the kind of man, he would want to know their background, and he would support them, and, mm-hmm. and I think they really cared for him and as a
nice.
Human being, and so I think that they... And we've told them that they really extended his life in a very good way.
Now, you mentioned you had one or two people that you had to fire. And being long distance, the first issue would be becoming aware that there was such a problem. And then, so what kinds of problems came up, and how did you become aware that this needed
right.
attention?
Well, I became aware through... one or two other caregivers. Some, you know, everybody's different, and some people are more likely to speak up and maybe complain in an unfair way about another caregiver. So
right.
you have to try to weigh
right.
these things. I also had a cousin who was very close to my parents and who I'd grown up with, who lives in Tucson and was the reason that my parents first started to travel there, because her parents had retired there. So my folks started to go there in the 70s. And she had strongly encouraged them to stay in Tucson when we were mm-hmm. making this decision. Mm-hmm. And I think having her there was an important part of the decision. But she was also someone who I could take data from and hear.
Right.
Again, I had to weigh, because nobody else can really be your eyes and ears. So you try to weigh all of this information. And then I was making regular trips as well. Plus the caregivers that we had came through an agency, and they had certain standards, and they helped us understand how to deal with these situations as well. In terms of what might have gone wrong, one woman was careless with the pills, which mm. somebody, they, I think we had some problems with her before that. Some of her personal habits weren't very good, and she was just a little careless and sloppy about some things. But, you know, to find someone on the weekend shift is a little harder, and I didn't want to rush
right,
into letting her go for reasons that were hard to articulate, but when people found a pill on the floor, in other words, she wasn't careful enough in giving him his pills that she'd drop it in the carpet and it would disappear, that seemed to push us over the line and let her go. We had some that were less effective than others, but you don't let them go for just that reason.
Right. As you say, it's hard to find people just with the right attitude.
Right.
Even if they're not always completely faithful with the routine.
Right.
If you have a caring person.
Right. I think we had one woman who became a little unreliable and would call late or have family problems or illness, and you just weren't sure. You can't have that too often.
No,
you can't have that too
right.
often.
Right.
But the agency that we used, we developed a pattern so that if somebody was going to be out, we would ask them to contact the other caregivers, or if they wanted to take a vacation, we would prefer to use the people that we were already used to and that my father knew, rather than bring a stranger in. But we did bring strangers in through the agency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, it worked out pretty well.
So the agency was providing some training and supervision.
They were providing people. We felt that the people on their list, by and large, were well qualified and were vetted and screened, and we could rely on them. And the interesting thing is this agency, I have to say, I was very impressed because they interviewed me and my
uh-huh.
father. They
yes.
didn't just send somebody over. They wanted to meet us in his home, and I was very impressed with that. Because she got a sense of who we were, who my dad was, what kind of situation it would be, rather
mm-hmm,
than just
mm-hmm.
having me call and say, I'm going to need somebody starting next Monday.
Right.
What's the rate?
Right.
So that impressed me, and by and large, we got some terrific, terrific caregivers through her.
Good.
Through this agency.
Good. So that must have helped you a lot, especially because you were managing this long distance, to
yes.
have people on the ground who could deal with the scheduling and the training
right.
and so forth.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's probably a little bit more expensive to work through an agency, but that it was providing you a level of service that you really needed.
Yes, but actually this agency, as it turns out, they charge us a finder's fee. They did not charge us once we paid the finder's fee based upon the first several months of the individual's work for us. That was it, and
okay.
then we simply paid the caregivers directly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We set up a payroll system and just had it taken care of, and
right.
had somebody write the checks.
Right.
So, I think I'm not describing all the problems, and there were problems even with this very fine. I would say it's just a living place. There were problems, but it's almost inevitable. I mean, I could tell you, I think another thing I wanted to say when you said what piece of advice I would have is that you're going to see that happen. You just cannot prevent, even if you live there in the same town and you visit frequently, if not daily, you are never going to have a perfect situation.
Right.
And I think you almost have to accept it and decide what the level of unacceptability is, because some problems will occur. I mean, in the assisted living place, I had them shower my dad because I wanted to keep them involved. Once I had these caregivers, I didn't want them to stop feeling that he wasn't a part of this place.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I had them do that, and I may have even had them supply the meds and handle the delivery of meds. And that worked, but they rotated their caregiving staff from time to time, and some people were better than others. And
right.
one day I find out that he's been showered and he's got this big gash on his top of his head. I said, what happened? He said, well, the woman was wearing this heavy jewelry and she scrubbed him and whacked him in the head. I mean, first of all, it wasn't very sensible for her to be wearing this jewelry, but things
right.
happen. And so over time, you know, eventually I took all the responsibilities away from these folks. But
it makes me think of one of the Dr. Spock's baby book, when in his instructions for how to bathe a child.
Uh-huh.
Step one, take off your watch.
Yes, exactly, exactly. not to protect, well, even to protect your watch.
Right, right.
exactly. That's right.
But it's another scratchy thing flailing around.
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly.
Anyway.
But even to the extent my father, when my mother was still alive, and my dad had gotten a cold, and he sort of took to his bed, any excuse to maybe lay down, take a nap. In fact, what happened was he got dehydrated, and he ended up in the hospital, and his doctor at the time said that he thought we were going to lose my father at the time. I mean, he was hallucinatory for 3 days, and they hydrated him, and he came back. But my dad's doctor thought he's not going to make it through here. My father was very resilient, in fact, and did bounce back from a number of things. But we had a doctor or the head nurse at the assisted living facility would check on my dad, and they say, well, give him some soup and give him some water and give him some juice. But he didn't take a lot, and he wasn't interested, and he'd just go back to sleep. And we weren't smart enough to realize, and hadn't been instructed to realize, how important this was. Mm-hmm. So there were some, I would say, serious oversights from the facility itself, including they didn't have a doctor on the staff. They had a head nurse, and I thought that should be sufficient, but sometimes difficult to get their attention. So you're always fighting these battles, and I think you try to work with these people and make them aware of what's needed and what's required, and if they have an objection, try to understand it and work through it.
Yeah, as you say, there's no perfect situation, but at least you were getting the level of support that you really needed in order to manage this long distance relationship, and it sounds like you did it very well.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you. We tried. The other thing, let me add one more thing.
Sure.
I think that again, if your parent or the individual is sort of has their wits about them, I think that not always directly, but they do exercise, not only should exercise a certain amount of control, but I think their wishes are very important, and as I said before, to the degree you can work with what their desires are, you need to do that, because my own feeling is if you hit 90 or 85, you kind of have the right to choose.
Yes.
And,
you do have some seniority.
Yeah, you have some seniority, and you do make your own decisions. And you can't make somebody choose to be happier or to live longer if they choose not to do certain things. I'm thinking about the exercise that we had asked my dad to do and things like that. And he'd say, I don't think so. Fine, I'm not going to make him exercise more. He has a right to decide if things. So.
Right. And it's hard parenting your parents.
It is hard, but I think, and really, again, I say that I negotiated with my mother, and I would say that's a pretty accurate description of how that happened. And in fact, the way it finally occurred is I was in Tucson visiting them, and we had not made any particular decisions, and I was visiting someone or out doing some errands, and I saw a sign that says groundbreaking da 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 for this new facility. And I came home and I said to my mother, you know, I just saw over at Handmaker that they're breaking ground for an assisted living facility, and I knew this was a Jewish facility. That's about all I knew. And she said, they have a good reputation. And to me, that was the go-ahead sign. That was the signal, the signal that said that she was going to accept this. Mm-hmm. And that was all I needed. I went over and I said, here's my deposit. And they said, we're not taking deposits. I said, oh, yes, you're taking this. We need first dibs on the largest unit that you have. We have two people here.
Yeah,
so
nice.
I think... you know, it is hard and it is awkward, but we all do it, I think. We all do it at some point in our lives, and our parents will hopefully accept that.
Yeah. And you weren't exactly 20 through all this.
No.
Presume you were like 20, 25 years younger than your 90-year-old parents.
Yes. This started, I was in my 50s, and really it went on before. It started in 97. I stopped working in 1997, actually, and then I transported them back and forth, really. So that wasn't a big commitment in terms of time and energy. I'd bring them in the fall and the spring from from Arizona to Iowa and back. And then I would visit, of course, other times with my golf clubs in hand, usually. Never without my golf club. But it was in 2001 that finally we moved them. And I shut down the apartment in Iowa and then later on drove out to Tucson with a friend, took the larger items that my mom wanted to keep and drove them out there. And so it was from 2001 to 2006 that this transpired.
Right. With all the families dispersed now across the United States, like what you've been describing.
Right.
Iowa, Chicago, Boston.
Right.
It makes it all that much more difficult. We're not all in the same house. We're not all in the same town. But it sounds like at least you were able to do this, and the finances were not a major barrier.
Right, that's right. Yeah, I think, again, we were very fortunate. We were particularly fortunate because I wasn't working, and I don't know, it would have been much more difficult had I been working, because I think everybody may understand this. I felt like nobody was going to do it quite as well as I was going to do it, to be perfectly honest. And if I think about how I would have handled it otherwise, I would have, I suppose, given my cousin more responsibility, who wanted the responsibility in Tucson. But my cousin wasn't as proactive or assertive as I would have been, as I am. Mm-hmm. I also had a friend in Tucson, a college friend, who became very friendly with my parents and my family, my brother as well, and I trusted her judgment tremendously. So there were occasions while I was in Boston and something would happen, and I asked her to check on it, and I relied on her opinion as to whether I needed to come out. Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling, had I been working, I would have used her more to be my eyes and ears, along with the lead caregiver and my cousin, and would have found a way. I would have developed some connection, perhaps at the assisted living, that would have been pretty reliable. I would have had to look for another avenue, in other words, of information, because it would have been very hard. But I think you do need to find a way to communicate and understand, rely on somebody that's got a good head on their shoulders and can tell you what's going on.
Had you thought about moving them closer to you? I know a lot of people move their parents to where they're now living.
Right. Again, when I talked with my mother about these things, I didn't think that was necessarily the best solution, because they knew nobody but me, and it was a cold climate.
Right.
Same thing in Chicago with my brother. So we didn't press that solution on them, and they didn't, not surprisingly, given who they were, they didn't think that was the best solution either. After my mother died, I said to my father, do you want to move to be near me? Do you want to come to Boston or Chicago? If I tell you what he said, I don't want to. he thought about it for a second, and then he shook his head no, and he said
go ahead.
He said no. He said, why should I inconvenience two of us? I said, well, I said, Dad, gee, I wouldn't have put it quite that way, but I was a little, he was a little bit of a jokester, but I think it was the right choice to stay there. I really do. I did spend a lot of time there, and I was very fortunate, and my father and I, and really my mother too, we were able to have not a lengthy, decline and passing, and they were both, very cognitively very sharp. And so, every time you visit, you never know if you're going to see them again, of course. But everything had been said, so I couldn't have been luckier, really, my brother and myself as well, as both my parents.
Well, thank you, Nancy. I appreciate your sharing.
Thanks a lot, Joyce. Okay. Lots of fun.
It's been particularly nice to speak with Nancy and hear the tone of respect and love that came through in her relationship with her parents in their final years. And we're going to come back in a minute and speak with Margaret about another similarly challenging experience. So stay with us now, and we'll talk with Margaret Smith in just a minute. Let's take a little break here. Don't go away. We'll be right back. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on the website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger by Clinton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. Hi, and welcome back. We're going to speak now with Margaret Smith, who has a slightly different perspective. She's not only taking care of aging parents, but she's also still working full-time and still taking care of children and grandchildren of her own. She's what we call from the sandwich generation, where she's in the middle, and there are children to be cared for, and there are aging parents to be cared for. It draws on your energy in a variety of ways, as you'll hear as we speak with Margaret.
And I know we had a conversation once about, you said you were feeling like the poster child for the sandwich generation, mm-hmm. with a boomerang child and a couple of needy parents.
Well, Jennifer went down to pick up the kids last Saturday, and got, fortunately, not too far outside of town when her car overheated. So we had to take a car down and give her my car to go on down and get the kids, and then limp her car back to our house. And it's been way down on the priority list this week, so we know what's wrong with her car, but we haven't had time to go get it fixed, so she's had my car all week. We've been dealing with Grayson's mom. So, yeah, mm-hmm, I feel pulled in many directions. it's interesting.
Yeah, I've been doing some reading about caregiving as a general topic and trying to, come up with some short lists. You know, it tends to be helpful to people to structure the conversation. And I'm trying to come up with the pressures, what kinds of pressures people are under as they get called upon to do caregiving. And of course there's the emotional pressure, there's changes in family dynamics, there's financial pressures, time pressures.
Yeah, time is probably the biggest for us, because at least with Grayson's mom, you know, the financial thing is set, because she's in a life care facility.
Mm-hmm.
Were she not in a life care facility, financial would be much higher on that list. But it's just the time, and it's, you know, and always the needs are immediate needs. So whatever your life had been scheduled for that day, it's now totally thrown to the wind, because there's now an immediate emergency time thing that has to happen.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you know, you lay out your plans for the day and then just be prepared to change everything.
Right, and with her in the life care facility, though, there was a period when things were relatively stable, that she was living independently.
She was living independently.
Within this facility, and, you know, so she had her circle of friends and her life, and you were able to schedule things reasonably well. But it's just
but
that as her health has degraded.
Yeah. And she went from independent to nursing home, and now from nursing home to assisted living, and which means and to get her into the life care facility was, you know, taking a 3-bedroom house and making it fit into a 2-room apartment when she wanted to take everything with her and hang every picture that had always hung in her house. And that presents a unique challenge. And then taking that 2-room apartment and scaling it down to a 1-room, and again, wanting to take everything and wanting to have all your pictures, and you know, that part of it presents such a interesting set of dynamics. And the only good part about this last move has been that she's mentally not with it enough to even question anything that she's not seen in her apartment. I have not gotten any questions about, well, where's the so-and-so, and what'd you do with this? I don't even think she's looked in half the drawers to see what's there and what's not there. Because she's just not that alert this time around.
Right, so it's become your responsibility to sort through her things, to compact them in a reasonable way and organize them so that she feels she's in familiar circumstance.
Right.
And then either dispose of or store the rest of her stuff.
Yeah.
Marvelous.
Where are you going to put it? What are you going to do with it?
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing you have an expandable attic.
Oh, no, I don't. Not in this house.
Tell me about the changes in dynamics of moving from being a child of this elderly parent to being essentially the parent of this elderly parent.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you now have to make the decisions. Whereas before, when you were a child, they made the decisions. And it's like with Daddy, I mean, you know, Lord, he changed our diapers, now we get to change his. And just sort of how Jimmy and I approach it, you know, well, this is what he did for us, now we get to do it for him.
Mm-hmm.
But it, like with Grayson's mother, it's, you know, you don't ask her what she wants to do, you simply tell her what will be done. And if you ask, then they're going to say, no, I don't want to do that. So you ask your questions in a directed answer manner.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can only get from them the answer that you need to get from them. Because if you leave it, if you give them choices, they will make the wrong choice.
And that's a very tricky thing, because you want to be respectful and you don't want to, like, tromp on their rights, but
right.
At the same time, you need to make sure that the outcome is going to be safe and the right kind of an environment for them to live well.
Mm-hmm. Like in her assisted living space, because it's a memory care floor, they can have no sharp objects. No scissors, no nail clippers, no metal nail files. And they didn't tell us that when I moved her things there. But the day we moved her there, they said, oh, now, does she have any scissors or sharp objects? And I'm like, yeah. Now, oh, she can't have those. Because this is a new floor and a new system, and they had two guys already up there, and they have Wonder Guard sensor system, so they cannot leave the floor. And the men were cutting their bracelets off. So they decided, oh, we better not have sharp objects up here. So by the time she got up there, they were like, let's don't have scissors. So I, with her in the apartment, I was trying to go back around and remember what drawers I had put what things in that were sharp and pocket them without her noticing what I was doing. And that was a challenge. I was like, keep talking to her. Just keep talking to her over there. So my little pocket was just bulging with sharp objects. So I was trying to strip the apartment. But yeah, so it, you know, it's every day is a new challenge, a new surprise. And you want, even with Daddy, I want so much to allow him to still have some dignity and still have the feeling of respect that he is entitled to and has earned, even though I have to do some menial tasks for him, which sort of strip him of those feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So... yeah, it's a fine line to try to do what has to be done and yet allow them the respect and dignity that they've earned.
Right.
We'll be right back with Margaret after this message. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on the website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger by Clinton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. By now, I'm sure you've realized that Margaret's dealing with some additional challenges beyond with what Nancy was dealing with. First, that both her mother-in-law and her father have significant dementia. Her mother-in-law has just gotten to the point where she's been moved from the assisted living to the memory care floor of a continuing care facility. Her father is still at home and is being cared for primarily by her 90-year-old mother. But Margaret and her brother supplement what her mother is able to do, along with some home health aides, to provide care for her father.
What would you say are the biggest challenges that you face in this situation?
Trying to make the necessary decisions for care and safety and even things like who's going to write the checks out of her checkbook, how do you keep her rings safe in a life care facility where she's not even allowed to lock her apartment door. Because she will probably lose the key. So on the memory care floor, they don't have the apartment doors locked. And so how do you secure her valuables and yet allow her to have her valuables so that she doesn't feel that she's been stripped of everything she's had her whole life?
Uh-huh.
So the challenge is to allow her to have enough of those things with her, but not everything, so that you don't have to worry about what may or may not be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because they tell you to treat these facilities as if it was a hospital room.
Yeah.
So you don't want to have a whole lot of valuables, and yet it's supposed to be their home, and so you want them to have enough of their possessions to feel like it is theirs, and they are still in charge, even though they're really not. And
mm-hmm.
that's probably the biggest challenge, is how to accomplish that in a loving and caring way so that the person doesn't feel that they have absolutely no control over their life now.
And what would you say are the greatest benefits or rewards for you in doing this work?
Well, like with Daddy, it's an opportunity for me to give back all the love and the care that he's given me my whole life. It's a way to help make these last years easier on Mom as she has to watch her life's partner slipping away from her.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to look at it as this is a pleasure and an honor to be able to be here to do this for them. Because what if I wasn't?
Yeah.
Then what would happen to them, or who would there be to do these things? So you have to keep telling yourself daily that it's my honor to be able to do this for them. And that helps to keep you going.
Yeah. Well, you certainly are doing a good job.
We're trying. We're just taking it one day at a time.
Yeah, it's a difficult period right now with all of the pressures from three different fronts coming together.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, you think you've got all the parents balanced, and then all of a sudden Jennifer's car breaks down. And you're like, now I got to go do the other end.
And not to mention that you're still working.
Yeah, there's a job that you have to keep juggling in there somewhere in all this.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, since I work from the house, I do have some flexibility within that. But like today, you know, Grayson's mother was having all this stuff going on, and I had customer appointments this morning, so it's like, well, we can't get there before X time. And then by the time Grayson and I got there, they're ready to take her back to the hospital again, and we're like, wait, what? Yeah, you just roll with it.
Are they getting her stabilized now, or what?
Well, they're keeping her overnight. The fluid on her lungs is bothering them, and one test showed an elevated something, and I don't remember the word the girl used, but anyway, she said it's a little elevated, and it's almost as if her body is trying to have a heart attack. So we'd rather keep her here and observe her through the night than to send her back,
right,
have her actually have a heart attack, and then not have enough time to react.
Yeah, if you're going to have a heart attack, the best place to do it is in the hospital.
Right, and so they've got her all wired up, and they're monitoring her, and she was complaining that her arm is being squeezed, and I said, yeah, but that's the blood pressure. I said, that's only happening about every 10, 15 minutes, and it's automatically done, and it'll do it, and then it'll release, and I said, yeah, it's going to just do it. I said, otherwise, somebody would have to keep running in here and restrapping you in and do the exact same thing. I said, so they just hook you up to a machine and it does it automatically. Oh, okay. So, why do I have these wires? Well, these wires are checking on this. Well, why do I have to have this thing on my finger? Well, that's how they check your oxygen levels. Well, do I have to have this thing in my nose? Yes, you do. That's giving you oxygen. Well, can I get oxygen some other way? Well, yes, by breathing, but you're not breathing in enough, so they want to give you some extra. So, yeah, you have all these questions that you would have from a six-year-old in the same exact situation. Why this? How come that? What is this for? And then 5 minutes later, you may get the exact same questions again because they don't remember that they ask or can't remember the answer you gave.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, just keep your patience right there with you at all times and remember that if it's this hard on your side, how much harder is it for them on their side if they remember enough to be aware of the fact that they're not remembering? And there are times that Grayson's mom says, yes, I know I forget things.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when Daddy will say, I can't think of the words I need, when he's trying to get a thought across. So at those times, you have to remind yourself that frustrating as it is for you when they can't complete their thoughts or carry the thoughts or keep asking the same questions, it is a million times harder for them when they become aware of the fact, and it comes and goes.
Yeah.
But there are times that they are aware of the fact that they can't remember and they don't retain. And that's got to be so much harder for them than it is for you to just be patient with them having to struggle to do it.
Right. And I think the other thing is that they feel that they should not be treated as a child. If they sense that they're being treated as a child, then
absolutely,
it's pretty bad.
Yeah. So you want to keep giving them that respect and dignity that they've earned by the sheer fact that they're your elder. And yet you want to phrase things in a way that doesn't talk down to them, and that still gives them the feeling of control without actually having the control.
Right.
So that people get into trouble when they start saying, okay, do you want to do this or this? And instead you simply say, today we look through the schedule and the best thing for us to do would be this. And you simply don't give them the other choices. You give them only the choice that is the best choice. And then it's not posed as if they had a choice, but it's like, oh, we looked at the schedule and we came. It's like, oh, we did? Yeah, we did. Don't you remember? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And you go do that. But if you lay out too many choices, then it's confusing for them, and then it's just that much harder for them to try to make a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder for them to feel that they're not being treated in a childish manner, because if they make the wrong choice, then you're stuck. Now what do you do? Okay, I gave them a choice, and that's not the thing I wanted them to do anyway. Now how do I get out of this? process.
Yeah, only if there are two acceptable choices. Yeah. You could give them a choice between two acceptable things, but
generally there's one thing that you need them to do.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes Daddy will say, you know, no, I don't want to get up. It's like, but don't you want to eat breakfast? Yes, I want to eat breakfast. Well, you know what? To eat breakfast, we're going to have to get up. So let's just do it. And then he'll usually go, okay. But sometimes he just, you know, what are you doing? Why are you making me do this? It's like, well, Mom's out there with your breakfast and she wants you to come eat it. Oh, okay. So, I mean, I went in one morning, good morning, Daddy, it's time to get up. And I pulled the covers back. He goes, what are you doing taking those covers away from me? I'm like, well, I can't get you up if you're in the covers. So, yeah, you just never know.
Right. And you can't let yourself get offended by it because it's not intended as offensive. It's just intended as a way of maintaining some control.
And there are times that they are simply not the person that they had been.
Yeah.
And so you have to remind yourself, this is not my dad saying this to me. This, because my dad would not be saying that. This is somebody else right now.
Uh-huh.
And you can't wear your feelings on your sleeve at all.
Right.
Because they will be hurt if you do.
Right.
And their awareness comes and goes. There are days that Daddy's much more aware. There are days that Grayson's mother's much clearer. And then there are other days that they're totally in a fog, totally somewhere else. And you just have to not get into word wars with them because it's not going to do any good. They're doing the best they can. And if they jump from generation to generation, just play along. Grandma Wilcox used to do that. I'd walk in the room, hi, Grandma, how are you? Oh, how are you? How's Curtis? How's Jennifer? Oh, they're fine. Well, do you think Dad's going to sell the farm? It's like, okay, I'm no longer her granddaughter. I am now her sister, and we're children in Limestoneville. So you go, oh, no, I don't think he will. Oh, that's good. Well, now is Jennifer okay? Oops, I'm back to being her granddaughter again. And it would switch within the same sentence. And you just tried to jump with it yourself and answer as appropriately as you could and hope that you knew what decade you were in. But, yeah, it, you know, so I've seen it with Grandma Wilcox, and now I get to take some of what I learned then and incorporate it into the caregiving that I'm required to do now.
Yeah. So essentially, you got some training from having had your grandmother in the house.
Mm-hmm. And I also had some very early training from watching Mrs. Taylor when her mother lived with them and she had dementia.
This was one of the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Her mother would stand there and point to her daughter at the kitchen sink, Mrs. Taylor, and she would say, who's that lady? Look at her. She's stealing our dishes. You know, and I'd say, oh, she's not stealing our dishes. She's just going to wash. You watch. She's putting them away where we can't find them. And Mrs. Taylor's response was to sing. And she sang all the time to keep from becoming overly frustrated by the fact that her own mother did not know who she was as she tried to care for her in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was in grade school, watching her deal with her mother, didn't realize it at the time, but I was actually filing away how do you be a good patient caregiver for somebody who is mentally not with it, who you have to care for as a person that you love and respect and honor. But they don't even know you.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's part of the emotional burden. So how do you take care of your own emotions? I mean, managing it by singing while she's there in front of her mother is one thing, but there's got to be a time when you just feel like going off and crying and you really need to take good care of your own self.
And sometimes you will just do that, but you do it at an appropriate time, not in front of the person.
Sure.
Yelling and screaming at or around the person is not going to help. So you
right.
hold your frustrations and your emotions as in check as you can until a time. And yeah, there are times you come home and you're sitting here all by yourself, and a good cry does wonders to just be an emotional release to allow you to then pull it back together and do the next day what you need to do yet again. Because if you don't release it at some point in some way, you'll allow it to build up so much that it's going to pull you down, and mm-hmm. you can't afford that, because you have to keep going to help these people.
Right. So what other things do you do to try to support yourself through this?
Keep a good sense of humor, smile a lot, laugh things off, try not to let anything sink down so deeply that you're going to retain the hurtfulness that goes along with it. Just keep reminding yourself that that's not them when they make cutting and hurting remarks. You know, that's not really them. So just kind of let that slide off like water on a duck's back. Mm-hmm. And having the support of my husband is very helpful, because we can commiserate with each other, since we both have parents that are in the same boat at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to remember that when one of us bites at the other, that it's not because we're frustrated with each other, it's because we're overloaded with the emotions and burdens of that particular day and that particular set of stresses. And then being able to say to the other person, oh, you know, I'm really not mad at you right now, I'm just overloaded. And then being able to sit down and talk about the overload.
Right, to be in touch with what the real feeling is that's mm-hmm. going on, and not let the communications get clouded by that.
Right.
Yeah. Good idea. Well, I hope everything goes as well as it can, and that the car gets fixed.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we can deal without the car right now. That is so far down on the list of priorities. It's just the radiator fan. It's like it's, but you can't drive the car without the radiator fan, so you're
right.
Here, drive my car. I know you're safe. We'll get to the car when we can get to the car. So.
And you're taking care of your granddaughter a couple days a week?
In the afternoons, after school, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah.
Is that an extra stressor, or is that a stress reliever?
Oh, that's just pure fun.
Oh, good.
Pure fun. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with me, and I really appreciate that.
So today we've had an introduction to caregiving and looked at the spectrum of activities that people are performing in their caregiver role, from the level one caregiver who visits, prepares meals, to the level five caregiver who is providing basic services that people can no longer do for themselves. Next week we'll talk with Mary Daly, who has been a caregiver for her husband with Alzheimer's, and we'll begin exploring the other kinds of caregiving that happen when someone in the family is in ill health, no matter what their age. So stay with us, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week for The Powerful Patient.